2 Kings chapter 9 is going to give, along with chapter 10, actually the next two chapters in the book of 2 Kings are going to give us the full details of the work of Jehu the son of Nimshi that God gave him to do in bringing destruction upon the house of Ahab. So he's going to kill Jehoram, Ahab's son, who is the king of Israel. And he's also going to have Jezebel, Ahab's wife, killed. All of that happens in 2 Kings chapter 9. And then chapter 10 is going to record for us the remainder of Jehu's destruction of Ahab's family. Hit 70 sons, as well as other family, and then the worship of Baal, Baal worship, and Baal's worshipers in the house of Baal that was in Samaria. Jehu's going to destroy all of that, and so there's two chapters that's going to describe for us God's judgment on Israel, the house of Ahab in particular, and also in going against Baal worship that had been introduced into Israel by Jezebel herself. So that's what we're going to be planning to study over the next bit of time that we have to cover that. So we want to start in 2 Kings chapter 9 with that. So by the time we finish chapter 10, 2 Kings 10, Lord willing, then we will be, when we get to chapter 11, then we're going to be really, we're going to be caught up in the narrative at the same point where we left off there in 2 Chronicles chapter 22 when after Ahaziah's death. So that'll get us back to that same point, and we can then start to look at what happens after that. So the next two chapters in 2 Kings, chapters 9 and 10, have details of what was briefly described in 2 Chronicles 22 of Ahaziah's death, and it mentioned Jehoram and how Jehu did that. But that was a very brief summary within a couple of verses there in 2 Chronicles 22, where we have two chapters of details in 2 Kings. So in chapter 9, verse 1, he begins, and we're going to read verses 1 through 13 now, 2 Kings 9, verses 1 through 13, that this part, these opening verses of chapter 9, are going to describe the anointing of Jehu as king, as then he is instructed to carry out God's vengeance and destruction on the house of Ahab. Of course, Jehu is going to very eagerly do that, but it's going to set the stage for what's going to come with all of those events. Verses 1 through 13 tell us how this was going to be a fulfillment of all of what God had planned. So 2 Kings chapter 9, starting in verse 1, he says, "And Elisha the prophet called one of the children of the prophets and said unto him, Gird up thy loins and take this box of oil in thine hand and go to Ramoth Gilead. And when thou comest thither, look out there Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him arise up from among his brethren and carry him to an inner chamber. Then take the box of oil and pour it on his head and say, Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then open the door and flee and tarry not. So the young man, even the young man the prophet, went to Ramoth Gilead. And when he came, behold, the captains of the host were sitting, and he said, I have an errand to thee, O captain. And Jehu said, Unto which of all us? And he said, To thee, O captain. And he arose and went into the house, and he poured the oil on his head, and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I have anointed thee king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel, and thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants the prophets and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab him that pisseth against the wall and him that is shut up and left in Israel. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat and like the house of Baasha the son of Ahijah. And the dog shall eat Jezebel in the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. and he opened the door and fled. Then Jehu came forth to the servants of his lord, and one said unto him, Is all well? Wherefore came this mad fellow to thee? And he said unto them, You know the man and his communication. And they said, It is false. Tell us now. And he said, Thus and thus spake he to me, saying, Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. And they hasted and took every man his garment and put it under him on the top of the stairs and blew with trumpets, saying, Jehu is king. So this is how Jehu became king. Now we read in just about every reference to him from the first one that we had. And by the way, when was the first time that we read about Jehu, the son of Nimshi? But all these passages where he's mentioned, he's referred to as Jehu, the son of Nimshi, where we actually see in verse 2 here in 2 Kings 9, he was the son of Nimshi, but Nimshi was actually his grandfather. He was the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Now, that's not the Jehoshaphat king of Judah that we had read about, but that Jehu's actual father was Jehoshaphat. His grandfather was Nimshi, but he's referred to as the son of Nimshi every other time. So this is, for some reason, he was identified principally with his grandfather. But that is not the only time that we see that convention followed in the scriptures. So just keep that in mind, though, when we're reading about Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as we do in all those references, that according to verse 2 here, that's actually his grandfather. But the first place that we saw him mentioned was back in 1 Kings chapter 19, when God spoke to Elijah the prophet when he was out in the wilderness, having fled from Jezebel. This is the chapter that was after the end of the famine in 1 Kings 18, and that famine came to an end when God sent fire down from heaven and consumed Elijah's sacrifice on his altar, along with the water and the stones and all of it, where he did not answer Baal's false prophets, because there is no Baal. And so that was exposed, the falsehood of Baal and his prophets, and they were killed on that day. And the people said, Jehovah, he is God. And so then when Jezebel found out about that, and that's when the famine ended, and it rained, the first rain in 3.5 years in Israel. But Jezebel swore a destruction on Elijah for what happened that day, and that he was going to, she was said that he would be killed if Elijah were not dead by that same time the next day. So giving him 24 hours. That was back in the first two verses of chapter 19. So Elijah fled. And when he was out in the wilderness and was out there where Mount Sinai is, but the Lord spoke to him out of that still small voice and told him he was not the only one left that was serving God, that there were still 7,000 in Israel that had not bowed to Baal. And that's that God said in verse 18. But just before that, in verses 15 through 17 here in 1 Kings 19, the Lord said to Elijah, Go return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu the son of Nimshi shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. And then the very end of the chapter records how he went to Elisha, and Elisha followed him from that day forward. We've also looked at a number of times some other events that caused a delay in the fulfillment of what God had said there. Did not change what God was going to do, but it changed the timing of it. When Elijah prophesied against the house of Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 22, and it actually will help us to go back and look at that because it ties directly into what Jehu is going to be doing here in 2 Kings chapter 9 and on into chapter 10 as well. But in 1 Kings chapter 21 21 rather, 1 Kings 21, in verse 22, God said to Ahab through Elijah the prophet, he says, I will make thine house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha the son of Ahijah, for the provocation wherewith thou hast provoked me to anger and made Israel to sin. And of Jezebel also spake the Lord, saying, the dog shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. Him that dieth of Ahab in the city the dog shall eat, and him that dieth in the field shall the fowls of the air eat. But there was none like unto Ahab which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. And he did very abominably in following idols, according to all things as did the Amorites, whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. And it came to pass, when Ahab heard those words, that he rent his clothes, and put sackcloth upon his flesh, and fasted, and lay in sackcloth, and went softly. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, seest thou how Ahab humbleth himself before me? Because he humbleth himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days will I bring the evil upon his house. Now, what is the implication there? If Ahab had not humbled himself like he did right there, when would God have brought that destruction to pass? In Ahab's days, in which case Elijah, the prophet who was speaking these words that day, he would have still been around, and he would have been the actual vessel used by the Lord to anoint Hazael king over Syria and to anoint Jehu, who was going to be the next king of Israel, to bring that destruction on the house of Ahab. But since God said, because Ahab humbled himself, and God said, as a result of that, he was going to delay the fulfillment of it until after Ahab's days, well, then that changed things as far as the timing was concerned. And that's why Elisha is the one that ended up anointing Hazael to be king over Syria in 2 Kings 8. And why it's now Elisha that sends this young man there, one of the children of the prophets, to anoint Jehu here in 2 Kings chapter 9. So we can see the effects of that decision God made to not bring to pass that punishment on Ahab and his family until after Ahab was gone. The Lord chose to bring it to pass now after these days of Jehoram's reign over Israel. And so that's why we're reading about Elisha doing this in 2 Kings 9. But those words that we just read in 1 Kings chapter 21, what God pronounced as far as that destruction on the house of Ahab, those same words are brought up by God's prophet and repeated here in 2 Kings chapter 9, how God was going to make the whole house of Ahab to perish, and he was going to make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha the son of Ahijah. So that's what God said through Elijah back in 1 Kings 21, and he repeats that here in 2 Kings chapter 9 in verses 8 through 8 and 9. And also, we saw in 1 Kings 21, God said that Jezebel was going to perish there in Jezreel by the wall of Jezreel. And there was not going to be anyone to bury her. And that is also repeated here in 2 Kings chapter 9 and verse 10. So the delay in the timing of this didn't change what God said he was going to do and in bringing it to pass. And God didn't forget what he had said in the meantime. He never does, of course. So he was going to bring to pass exactly what he said, and now's the time. And that's what happens here at the hand of Jehu, the son of Nimshi. So he was the one that God had specifically chosen by name back in 1 Kings 19. Now here in 2 Kings 9, he's going to have him anointed as king of Israel, and he's going to then execute this judgment on the house of Ahab to fulfill all of these things that God said. This is not the normal way. Well, it kind of is in the northern kingdom of Israel. It became the normal way there. But this isn't the normal way when you have a kingdom with kings for the next king to begin his reign. What's the normal convention for how the kingship passes from one to another? Well, when one king dies, then his son would be the heir and would become king. Now, things get more complicated if there's not a son to inherit. So sometimes that would be a problem and in a kingdom, and those kinds of things even persist to the present day in certain nations or kingdoms. But otherwise, then, there would be some other heir from the family that would typically take the throne. We saw that when Ahaziah, Ahab's son, died, and he didn't have any children, so the kingdom couldn't go to his children. So then it went to his brother, Jehoram, the one that's still king and is going to be killed by Jehu here in chapter 9 of 2 Kings. So if there's no direct heir of a son, then it would be chosen usually in that manner. This is going to be different. Now Jehoram is not going to leave this kingdom to his son. It's not going to go to any other brothers of his. It's not going to go to anybody of the house of Ahab. Really, the house of Omri, going back to where the dynasty started, Ahab's father, Omri. It's not going to be of any of the family. Jehu's not related to any of them. He becomes the next king. So having Jehu anointed as king and have them, and for his the servants of his to then proclaim him to be king, and taking their garments and putting it under him on the top of the stairs, they're blowing trumpets saying, Jehu is king. That's not the way that that a king comes to reign and under normal circumstances. Now, we did mention this has happened a few times already in Israel. In fact, in the cases that the Lord mentioned there in verse 9, when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was the first king of the divided kingdom of Israel, when he died his son became king very briefly, and then Baasha killed him, and then at the end of Baasha's reign, now Jeroboam and his family, they were destroyed, the entire house, because of those sins that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, walked in when he made a new religion for his kingdom and forbade the people and prevented the people from obeying God's commands and from following the Lord's religion, which was the only right one for Israel. And so he had his false priests, he had his false altars, he had those golden calves that he had made and put in Dan and Bethel to be worshipped. And so he had his own feast days, all of these things that were not in accordance with God's will and commandments, and actually was intentionally chosen by Jeroboam to replace what God had established to prevent his subjects, those in his kingdom, from going to Jerusalem like God had commanded them to do, which was the capital now of the rival kingdom, the southern kingdom of Judah. Jeroboam did all that thinking that was going to preserve his kingdom, when it actually led to its destruction. And that's why God pronounced that utter destruction on his family. And Baasha was the one that carried that out. But then what did Baasha do? Baasha walked in the same sins that Jeroboam had walked in. And because of that, because he didn't repent of those sins, then God pronounced the same punishment on Baasha, Well, he died, and his son very briefly became king. And then he was Zimri, his captain, killed him. Now, that's something that Jezebel's going to bring up in 2 Kings chapter 9, that particular part of the history. She's going to ignore the key points of it, but she is going to bring up the fact that Zimri, who had been Baasha's captain, had rebelled against his master, and then and that's the one that Omri, Ahab's father, killed so that he could become king. And so back in 1 Kings chapter 16, if we can go back there and refresh on that, this will help us. And when Jezebel is met by Jehu, we can see what she is talking about or understand what event she's referring to, even though it's her twisted version of history, and it was not going to save her, and what her interpretation of it was not going to come to pass at all. And so the Lord pronounced by, this is a different Jehu, in 1 Kings chapter 16 and verse 7, this was what God had to say through Jehu the prophet. This was Jehu the son of Hanani. And verse 7, it says, "Also by the hand of the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, came the word of the Lord against Baasha and against his house, even for all the evil that he did in the sight of the Lord, in provoking him to anger with the work of his hands, and being like the house of Jeroboam, and because he killed him. In the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Elah, the son of Baasha, to reign over Israel in Tirzah 2 years, and his servant Zimri, captain of half his chariots, conspired against him as he was in Tirzah, drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, steward of his house in Tirzah. And Zimri went in and smote him and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his stead. And it came to pass when he began to reign, as soon as he sat on his throne, that he slew all the house of Baasha. He left him not one that pisseth against a wall, neither of his kinfolks, nor of his friends. Thus did Zimri destroy all the house of Baasha, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake against Baasha by Jehu the prophet. For all the sins of Baasha and the sins of Elah his son, by which they sinned, by which they made Israel to sin, in provoking the Lord God of Israel to anger with their vanities. Now the rest of the acts of Elah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? In the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, did Zimri reign 7 days in Tirzah." So he was God's instrument to bring the judgment and destruction on the house of Baasha. And then he reigned as king for a full week. It says, "And the people were encamped against Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines. And the people that were encamped heard say, Zimri hath conspired and hath also slain the king. Wherefore all Israel made Omri, the captain of the host, king over Israel that day in the camp. And Omri went up from Gibbethon, and all Israel with him, and they besieged Tirzah. And it came to pass, when Zimri saw that the city was taken, that he went into the palace of the king's house and burnt the king's house over him with fire and died. For his sins which he sinned, in doing evil in the sight of the Lord and walking in the way of Jeroboam, and in his sin which he did to make Israel to sin." So that was the end of Zimri. Now notice, Zimri was Baasha's captain, and he killed his master to bring the destruction that God had pronounced by his prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, for all of the sins that they had committed. Now Baasha had been the instrument of the Lord to do that to the house of Jeroboam, which was executed there at the beginning of chapter 16, after Jeroboam had died and his son Nadab had become king very briefly. So you had the first dynasty, Jeroboam's, if you can even call it a dynasty, a father and then a son who reigned for a year. Then Baasha took it over by killing the king and all of his family, but that was what God had pronounced against Jeroboam's family for all the evil. But Baasha walked in the same sins, and when he died and his son Elah was king very briefly for a year, just like Jeroboam's son Nadab had been, and then it's his captain, which is that what we would call the general, the chief of the army, was the one that that had him killed. Well, that, do we see that kind of thing today? Where, I mean, really, whoever commands the allegiance of the military is the, who's really going to have the power. Isn't that true? And those kinds of things happen. Well, just recently in Myanmar, which, you know, Burma, that was not very long ago, where the military took over there, and that happens in lots of places. And if when the military decides to back somebody else, then what can the other person do as far as holding on to their power? They don't have any force behind it. So that's why we frequently, even in the Bible times, we'll read about one of the military leaders being the one to take over rulership if they rebel against their master, which is what Zimri did against Baasha. But then who was the other captain? Omri, who then killed Zimri so he could become king. Now, of course, Jezebel's going to leave that part out. She's going to condemn Jehu, who is Jehoram's captain. It served under Ahab as well, but he's the leader of the military. And so she's going to compare him to Zimri, which is not entirely a false comparison in the fact that, well, yeah, they both were the military leaders under their masters, the king, and they both conspired against their master, the king, and killed him. Zimri did that to Baasha's son, Elah, and then killed all his family. Jehu's going to do the exact same thing to all of Ahab's family. But Jehu was commanded by God to do that. Now, we don't have a record of God telling Baasha to be the one to do that against Jeroboam's house. He just said it would happen. But did God send a prophet to anoint Baasha and tell him to go do it? No, and that's why we read a while ago when it said why Baasha was destroyed by the Lord. It was for walking in the sins of Jeroboam and continuing in that, and because he killed him. It mentions that too. So when God hadn't instructed him to do that, was that right for him to kill the king? Lift up his hand against the king and his master? No, and he was punished for it. Really, Omri is the one that did exactly what Zimri did. Jehu's different in that God specifically had prophesied that he would be the king and sent his prophet to anoint him as king and told him to go and execute that judgment on the house of Ahab. So was Jehu wrong to do what God told him to do? And was he truly in rebellion against his master to become king when God had chosen him to be? Well, let's ask the question about David. I mean, King Saul, when he was the first king of Israel, his son Jonathan was his heir, was the heir to Saul's throne, but God made the determination that he would not have the kingdom to continue with the house of Saul. Well, because Saul was evil. Of course, even going back before that, even going back to the days of Jacob, I mean, God had made the decision that Judah would be the royal tribe in Israel, and that he was going to ultimately bring his son as the king of kings through that tribe, which he did. So being Saul being of the house of Benjamin, that wasn't going to fit into God's overall plans anyway, and what God had already foretold long before. The fact that Saul, and God knew what he was doing when he chose Saul, and so Saul, of course, rebelled against the Lord, and God made that determination. He wasn't going to continue to allow Saul's family to rule over Israel, but he chose one who was a man after his own, after God's own heart, who was David, that was the son of Jesse of the tribe of Judah. Completely different family, completely different tribe. Well, was David guilty of rebelling against Saul? That's what Saul accused him of. But was David a rebel? Not at all. God anointed, had Samuel the prophet anoint David to be king. Now, he didn't tell David to kill Saul and his family. God was going to have Saul to go out another way. In fact, David had opportunity to do that and refused twice and said he was not going to lift up his hand against the Lord's anointed. And he forbade any of his servants from doing that. So David didn't do that and refused to do that. He was not instructed to do that, but he was chosen by God to be the next king and to do that, that part of it, to accept that from God was right because that was God's choice. And even Jonathan, the one who would have been the heir to Saul, accepted that because it was from God, because his faith was in God and he was seeking to please the Lord, not to be an earthly king. So we've already seen that happen. So when God makes a choice and anoints somebody to be king, for them to be king was not a mark of rebellion. In this case, Jehu was anointed to be king and was commanded to go and bring this destruction on the house of Ahab. So Jehu was doing something there that was God's commandment. So he was not like Zimri in that. He wasn't like Baasha, Zimri, or even Omri. And of course, Jezebel's not going to mention Ahab's father, her father-in-law, and what he had done to become king. But she's got her twisted version of history. And of course, Zimri was, just like Baasha was punished for having killed his master, so was Zimri. And she's going to be suggesting from this that that means that Jehu was going to end up being killed for his rebellion. But it wasn't actual rebellion. God made that decision. But she doesn't believe in God and doesn't believe in any of that anyway, which is why this is going to happen to her. So this is what God had done now to make Jehu to be king, to be his instrument to bring this destruction on the house of Ahab. And so that's now what happens. So he goes to Jezreel. Let's read verses 14 to 20 back in 2 Kings chapter 9. 2 Kings 9, verses 14 through 20. So Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. Now Joram had kept Ramoth-Gilead. That means he was going there and had his army there. He had just lost a battle there and was wounded there, Jehoram was, and then he had gone to Jezreel to recover from the wounds, but he still had his army there. So that's why Jehu, his captain, was at Ramoth and Gilead. And so that's what that's explaining there, verse 14. Now Joram had kept Ramoth Gilead, he and all Israel, because of Hazael, king of Syria. So they were having to remain there. They were trying to recover the city, and they had not succeeded, but the army was still there to try to watch over and look for an opportunity to take that from Hazael. Now, again, this is, you remember when Elisha was weeping when he anointed Hazael to be the next king of Syria, and then Hazael killed his master, Ben-Hadad, and became king, and back in chapter 8 of 2 Kings, And Elisha was weeping with his knowledge of the evil things that Hazael was going to do to God's people in fighting against them. Well, he's doing that now. So we see that being fulfilled here also as Hazael is now king of Syria. And so in verse 15 it says, "But King Joram was returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds which the Syrians had given him when he fought with Hazael, king of Syria. And Jehu said, if it be your minds, then let none go forth nor escape out of the city to go tell it in Jezreel." So here are these ones where in Ramoth-Gilead, where Jehu was, they lay their garments down on the stairs and they blow trumpets, Jehu is king. They're going to be the ones not to allow anyone to get out of there to go and warn Jehoram the king that Jehu's coming. Well, who is this that's immediately accepting him as the next king and supporting him and acting in this fashion to enable him to be able to to go and secure the kingdom by killing the king. Well, of course, it's his own servants, it says. So these are the army people. He's the top of that. So these are his commanders under him. So he has the support of his people in the army. Otherwise, if they had their allegiance to Jehoram and not to him, then this would have ended right there, because they would have killed Jehu on the spot. But they're backing their master Jehu against Jehoram, who was the king. And so they're not allowing anybody to go get out of there, to go to Jezreel and warn Jehoram that Jehu is coming. So verse 16 says, so Jehu rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram lay there. And Ahaziah, king of Judah, was come down to see Joram. We read about that last week in 2 Chronicles 22. And it says, and there stood a watchman on the tower in Jezreel, and he spied the company of Jehu as he came and said, I see a company. And Joram said, take a horseman and send to meet them, and let him say, is it peace? So there went out on horseback to meet him and said, there went one on horseback to meet him and said, thus saith the king, is it peace? And Jehu said, what hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. And the watchman told, saying, the messenger came to them, but he cometh not again. So Jehu didn't let the messenger go back and return to his master. What have you got to do with peace? You get behind me. So you keep going. Don't turn around and go back. But the watchman sees that. So they send out a second. Verse 19, then he sent out a second on horseback, which came to them and said, thus saith the king, is it peace? And Jehu answered, what hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. And the watchman told, saying, he came even unto them and cometh not again. And the driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he driveth furiously. Well, he's the captain of the army. Why was he noted to drive his chariot in this type of manner? Well, he was a man of war, and he was fighting in war. He was very obviously skilled in his job. He would have to, I mean, in the heat of battle, how would they have to maneuver their chariots? I mean, he was a wild driver. I mean, that's the point there. I mean, he was known for that in his battle. So he was, from the way he operated his chariot, he was known among everybody for that, very obviously. And so they recognized his style of driving. Why is he employing that now? Well, he's not in an actual battle at the moment, but what's he going for? I mean, he's not casually riding up there to where Jehoram the king is. He's not allowing there to be any time for preparation for escape. He's coming just like he would do in a battle, because there is going to be an actual battle with these two kings, very brief though. He's recognized by his style of driving before he is seen close enough for it to be identified by his physical features. So in verse 21, and Jehoram said, make ready. And his chariot was made ready, and Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot, and they went out against Jehu and met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. Now, is that by coincidence? This meeting is going to occur right there in the place where Naboth had been, in the portion of his vineyard that had been taken. What did God think of that? When that was a man who was a godly man, had his inheritance that belonged to him by lot from what God had determined. So he was holding on to that, and I mean, he served the Lord, and he wouldn't break God's commandments and go and give up his inheritance because Ahab coveted it. So by that unfortunate geography that existed there, where his vineyard was next to Ahab's palace, So he coveted that. And then out of that covetousness, then here was this righteous man who was falsely accused and then murdered. And then his vineyard taken by the king. What did God think of that? What has he already done? He's already pronounced the destruction on Ahab himself, and he died from wounds at Ramoth-Gilead, but said the dogs were going to lick up his blood in the place where Naboth's blood had been shed there. And that's what happened back in 1 Kings chapter 22, in fulfillment of what God prophesied against him that we also saw a bit of in 1 Kings 21 a moment ago. So here in the very same place there in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite that Ahab had taken, now this is where Ahab's son is going to die. So God is taking vengeance and executing great judgments on Ahab and his family because of that wickedness of coveting the property of an innocent and righteous man and then having falsely accused him and murdered him. I mean, it was, thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. I mean, how many of the Ten Commandments were broken with what happened with Naboth back in 1 Kings 21? I mean, that's at least four right there. And God did not take that lightly, obviously. So this is the very same piece of ground where Jehu is now going to kill Ahab's son Jehoram. Verse 22, it says, and it came to pass when Joram saw Jehu that he said, is it peace, Jehu? And he answered, what peace, so long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many? Well, that answers the question very well. When Jezebel repents of all of her wickedness, then there might be peace. Well, is that going to happen? No. So he's mentioning here then what is behind this judgment of God against her and against now Jehoram also. Verse 23, and Joram turned his hands and fled and said to Ahaziah, there is treachery, O Ahaziah. And Jehu drew a bow with his full strength and smote Jehoram between his arms, and the arrow went out at his heart, and he sunk down in his chariot. I mean, that's a pretty powerful shot to make an arrow go that deep all the way through like that. But it did. And it was very accurate and very effective, and that's the end of Jehoram there. Then said Jehu to Bidkar, his captain, so now he's the one that has a captain, take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember how that when I and thou rode together after Ahab his father, the Lord laid this burden upon him. Now this is something that was not recorded. These words that he's quoting right here are not words that were quoted there or included in what Elijah had pronounced against Ahab by God's word back in 1 Kings 21. So we didn't have this there, but it obviously was spoken, and Jehu knew about the words and recognized that they were to be fulfilled. And he instructed Bidkar, his captain, to make sure that it was. So in verse 26, here are the words. Surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons, saith the Lord. So that's a little bit interesting too, because that is also a detail that was not included in 1 Kings 21. We read about Naboth's death, but Naboth had a family. Just killing Naboth is not going to allow his vineyard to be taken because he's got heirs. So not only did Naboth had to be killed, what else had to happen? So they wiped out his family, him and his family, his sons. So God was taking vengeance. So it wasn't just one man that died there for Ahab to be able to take his land. He had to wipe his family out. And what's going to happen to his family? That's the point here. So the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, saith the Lord. And he says, and I'll requite thee in this plat, saith the Lord. Now therefore take and cast him into the plat of ground according to the word of the Lord. So that was part of the fulfillment, as we saw something similar, remember, with that happened with Jehoram, Jehoshaphat's son, who had killed all of his brothers when he became king over Judah, having married Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, and then what happened to all of his sons, except for one that God preserved, Ahaziah, in order to preserve David's throne in Judah. Well, all of his sons got killed, and God had mentioned through Elijah the prophet in the letter that he had written to Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, that God was going to bring destruction on his family because of all the evil that he had done. And he also specifically mentioned because of his killing his brothers who were more righteous than he was. So his sons got killed, except for Ahaziah. Well, now Ahaziah is going to get killed. But Ahaziah has a son, Joash, that's very young and is going to be, he's a baby, and he's going to be preserved alive and become the next king of Judah. But that's coming later, Lord willing, in our study. But for now, we can see that how God's judgment was on Ahab, not just on Ahab, but all of his family. And because Ahab had killed Naboth and his sons, not only were the dogs going to lick up Ahab's blood in that place, but Ahab's son was going to fall there too. And that was fulfilled. So very same location for that reason. Was that just? Ahab kills a righteous man and his sons to take his vineyard, and for that wicked man and his wicked son to die in the same spot. Was that righteous? That was righteous judgment by God for that. Well, the next thing that mentions there coming up is how Ahaziah was killed also in verses 27 to 29. And then the rest of the chapter is going to record Jezebel's death exactly in accordance with the prophecies that the Lord had pronounced against her for all of her evil. So we will, Lord willing, finish up that in chapter 9 next Sunday. But as we are out of time now, we'll close by going again to our Heavenly Father in prayer.